This is a work of fiction, and most of the characters and situations are imaginary and not real. However, considering the time and backdrop of the story, certain individuals and events have been incorporated who and which are real to provide an authentic feel to the story. The political events and timelines described in the story are true and have been used to enhance the story. No political leader or political party is sought to be maligned or criticized, as this is not a political commentary but a work of fiction. The political climate of South Africa has been recreated with the help of numerous open sources of information freely available on the internet. Vanished, a political thriller created by Ravi. Chapter 1. Vanished. Shreya just called me. Her voice was trembling, and I was afraid that the worst news we were all waiting for had arrived. She said nothing, but asked me to come over to her house. When I reached her house, she had tears in her eyes, and she gave me a letter to read. It was from the Life Insurance Corporation of India, informing Shreya that a sum of rupees 10 million had been credited to her bank account in full and final settlement of her claim on the life of the deceased Mr. Srikant Sharma. Is that it? Madan, is it all over now? Am I supposed to tell myself that Srikant is dead? I think I must look like a widow now. She grabbed her Mangal Sutra with her left hand and put the index finger of her right hand on the red dot of sindoor on her forehead. These are not needed now. Shall I remove them, Madan? Shreya, please don't do that, I said. You must understand that this is a legal process. It has been almost 9 years, and you know, we had to obtain a legal certificate for Srikant because after 7 years, the courts presume that a person is dead. But we do not know for sure, do we? My heart says he is still alive. Madan, my heart says so too. But is he? Why did he leave us like this? What happened to him? Does anyone know where he is? Shreya, the universe hides so many mysteries from us, and we have been able to unravel only a few since man came on earth. Srikant too is a mystery, at least for now. We cannot give up on him. But he has, Shreya said. How can he be so cruel? We had been friends for almost 40 years, Srikant and me. 40 years is a long time to understand a person well. But I can't say this for my friend Louis. We went to the same school for the last 3 years of our schooling life, then to the same college to do our graduation in commerce, and then again spent a couple of years in the same college and finished our post-graduation. Louis was a ranker and was picked up for a lucrative job by an American MNC, while I took the bank entrance exams and landed a job with the State Bank of India. Over many years, our paths kept crisscrossing, and we never felt disconnected. Louis went overseas, first a posting in New York, then to Stockholm, and then to Johannesburg. We used to exchange letters when there was no email. He was there for my wedding and I for his. We became close without having to make the effort and without realizing that we were close to each other. We never exchanged our problems, nor sought help to resolve them. It was one of those relationships where physical presence was not essential, words superfluous, and emotions did not matter. Some part of both of us recognized and accepted this relationship. We seldom met, but when we met, it was as if we had been seeing each other frequently. Our families knew about us, but I cannot say we were family friends. Yes, I knew his wife and children well, but did not share any special relationship with them. It was in 2007 that he gave up his lucrative job in South Africa and settled in Mumbai. I was already there working for the bank. He bought an apartment quite close to mine. Our families were settled with our children married. It was therefore shocking and surprising when he simply vanished from our lives one day, 3 years after his return to India. It all happened so suddenly that we could not even foresee, let alone avert, his disappearance. One morning, he just left home and never returned. Listen in to chapter 2. Don't miss it. Vanished. Vanished, created by Ravi. Chapter 2, The Discovery. The years after Louis's disappearance were tormenting, tumultuous, and, if I may add for myself, enlightening. Louis got his nickname after we, along with a few friends, had seen the Disney version of The Jungle Book. That was long years ago, when we were still young. The animated movie featured a monkey called Louis, the Monkey King, who loved bananas. Srikant loved bananas too, and never missed the opportunity to have them. One of our friends then started calling him Louis, and thereafter the name stuck. Louis's disappearance perplexed everyone. His son and daughter, both married and settled abroad, waited for a month or so and then flew to India to stand by their mother. Some of his relatives turned up too, and soon his house had become a camp. Shreya was devastated. They had been married for 30 years, and their marriage seemed to be perfect. She kept saying that Srikant gave her no reason to grumble or grudge, and that he was near perfect husband. Those who knew him vouched for his character. He was not one of those wayward husbands who indulged in clandestine affairs with other women. His children loved him the most, and they could just not believe that their father would do something so drastic. Speculation was rife. Theories about his vanishment abounded. The first thought was that he had met with an accident and was in some hospital. This was ruled out as we teamed up to comb virtually every hospital in the town. The police too did their search and came up with nothing. The second theory was that he had been waylaid, killed, and dumped in the sea. Some of us had connections with the police at the higher levels, and they pulled strings to ensure that they followed every possible lead diligently. One senior police officer suggested that we hire the services of a reputed investigation agency to trace Srikant. After much deliberations, we hired the best possible investigators. This agency assigned the case to one of its best investigators, one Chandrakant Trimbakat. This man was considered to be the Sherlock Holmes of India. He had solved some very complex cases, which even the police department acknowledged. The investigations went on for almost a year before Chandrakant returned his report, saying that he could not trace Srikanth. He had hunted for him everywhere and had worked even with the underworld, which was apparently more equipped than the police. He had activated every single informant he knew, apart from those loyal to the police. No results. Srikanth had vanished without a trace. Airports, seaports, railway stations, bus stations, taxi operators, bus operators, every single exit route was checked. Nobody had seen him. The third theory on his disappearance was that he was kidnapped, but as there was no ransom call, this theory was discarded. The last of the theories was that he had voluntarily chosen to disappear. Hindus believe that there are four stages in our lives. The first stage is Brahmacharya or student life. The second is the Grihastha Ashram or the married life. The third stage, Vanaprastha or the retired life. And finally, there is Sannyasa or the renounced life. Many of us believe that Louis had renounced his material life for a spiritual one. There are instances where completely satisfied and rich people just give up everything and lead the life of an ascetic. Some choose to go to the Himalayas and become sannyasis. Others find a spiritual guru and join his or her ashram. This theory appealed to the majority, more so because other theories had been proved wrong. I never got the impression that Louis was religious to the extent of being allured by sannyasa. He was God-fearing, just like all of us. He did believe in visiting temples, doing puja and other routine forms of worship that an average Hindu would do. His children did not subscribe to this theory, but nevertheless, we asked the agency to probe this angle too. All known godmen were contacted and their ashrams searched across the country. But in the end, there was nothing to report. We soon ran out of theories. The visiting relatives left and so did the children, though reluctantly. They wanted Shreya to accompany them, afraid that leaving her alone would compound her misery and maybe drive her to sickness and depression. Shreya refused, saying that she would rather wait for her husband than going far away from him. I assured the children that we would take care of her. I live nearby with my family and my wife Mandira would be with Shreya as long as necessary. Once the investigations were over, there was a lull in the case and we did not know what to do. Shreya was yet to get over the shock of Louis' disappearance. More than the disappearance, she could not stop tormenting herself continuously. Where did he go? What was he doing now? Why did he disappear? Was he alive or dead? What was rankling was the fact that Louis had betrayed her trust, left her alone with these question marks. Question marks that pricked like daggers into her. She could live with a dead husband, but how could she spend her life with someone who was neither dead nor alive? I could understand her predicament, but could not help her in any constructive way. I advised her to visit a counselor or a psychiatrist who could help her deal with her tensions. It was around this time that I discovered the diaries. I found them on my bookshelf at my home, cleverly hidden behind the rows of books. They were Srikanth's personal diaries, and there were three of them. How he put them there, I do not know. When he did it, I cannot say. As to why he kept them on my bookshelf, there was a partial answer, a brief handwritten note. The note was cryptic and hardly said anything about the contents of the diaries. It was handwritten all in capitals. "My dearest friend, I am leaving these diaries with you in the hope that you will not share the contents with anybody, not even Shreya. Louis." I did not know what to make of the note. The fact that it was written in capital letters created doubts in my mind as to whether it was written by my dear friend or not. What was there in the pages of the diaries that he felt could not be shared even with his life partner? Was there any connection between these diaries and his disappearance? The timing of the discovery could not have been worse for me. Everyone was searching for answers and the lost man. The investigation agency was conducting a nationwide search without yet coming up with any worthwhile clue. The family was desperate to find something to raise their flagging hopes. What do I do now? If the diaries had any positive explanation for his disappearance or provided information on his whereabouts, it would only be justified that I must hand them over to the authorities. My friend did not want me to share the diaries with anybody, and I would be guilty of breaching the trust that he had placed in me. What was right? Helping find a lost man or honoring his request? I could not bring myself to read the diaries until my inner conflict was resolved. At the same time, I was burning with curiosity to see what was inside them, eager to know why Louis vanished, and burning with excitement at what kind of explosive content they contained. I dreaded to look at them, sitting calmly on my bookshelf. They seemed to be laughing at me, mocking my state of indecision, challenging me to pick them up and start reading. I lost sleep and appetite, and my wife noticed it and expressed her concern. I told her that I was worried about Shreya and her children and how they must be going on with their lives despite such a catastrophic event. I hid the diaries away from my sight so that I do not give in to my urge to read them. I was battling with the situation in my mind. Weeks passed by and I would not go near the diaries. Then it struck me that I could perhaps read them and then decide whether to share the information with Shreya and the authorities. It seemed fair that my primary responsibility was now with the devastated family rather than with my friend. I no longer felt guilty that I would be breaching my friend's trust. He had said in the note that he hoped that I would not share the diaries with anybody. It was not a request or a direction, it was an appeal. Again, I had never given my word to him that I will keep his secrets, so I would not be breaking any promise. This line of thought gave me comfort, and I decided to read the mysterious contents of the diaries. As I plunged into the handwritten pages, I could see a new Srikanth emerge, one that I had no knowledge about. It was like a stranger materializing out of Louis we knew. Even in my wildest dreams, I could never imagine the new Louis. No, this was not Louis. This was Srikanth Sharma. What I read shook me with a violence that surprised me. Even after I read the damned diaries, I was shaking with fear and tension. Fear because the story I had just finished reading blew my mind. It was like a thriller movie that we often watch in the theaters. Tension because the story did not end as I was hoping. I had hoped that the diaries would reveal the mystery behind his disappearance and provide valuable clues that would help in tracing his whereabouts. There was nothing in the diaries to indicate where he went. A number of confusing possibilities did suggest as to why he vanished. I could not get any information about what actually happened to him but my fears about his death grew. The one thing I could concede was that he was probably murdered after he vanished. He knew that he would be hunted down, and maybe this drove him to do the disappearing act. Maybe he thought that he had the chance to escape and live. Maybe he wanted his family to be safe and therefore left without telling anyone. My mind was exploding with dreadful possibilities. Could the family still be in some kind of danger? Should I go straight away to the police with these diaries? If I do, the truth about Srikant Sharma will be out, and that could be more devastating to the family than his disappearance or death. End of chapter 2. Vanished, created and narrated by Ravi. Chapter 3, The South Africa Saga, Part 1. Srikant Sharma was born in the year 1955 in Lucknow. He went to La Martinière College at the age of 5 and continued in the school till the 8th grade, when his family had to move to Delhi. It was in Delhi at St. Columbus that I met Srikant, and thus began our long association. It was a coincidence that we shared the same birth date and year. Srikant was a brilliant student and consistently stood first in his class. He was admired by his teachers and fellow students alike. The school he went to in Lucknow was the best in town, and the rich and the famous of Lucknow sent their wards there. Srikant had good friends, and amongst them, he was particularly close to Vijay. Vijay's father was a trader by profession who ran a successful business, trading different commodities. Vijay was a good student and street smart. The relationship between the two good friends was broken when Srikant had to move to Delhi. Though they were hardly in touch again, the relationship was destined to revive after years and impact Srikant's life in the weirdest possible manner. During Srikant's stint with the MNC company in Delhi, he proved his mettle as a finance wizard. The company, pleased with his results, decided to post him to its New York headquarters. Here, Srikant came in contact with several global players and a cross-section of the best global finance companies. His understanding of global financing was vastly enhanced by his interactions with experts, and soon he found a lot of companies wooing him to switch jobs. He left his current job and went to Stockholm, and then to Johannesburg in South Africa, this time at the bidding of his old friend Vijay. In 1991, he had visited India and was in Delhi for an investor meeting. The high-profile meeting was held at a 5-star hotel. It was there that he ran into Vijay, who happened to be in India on a business visit. They were both in the lobby of the hotel when Vijay spotted him and waved. "What a pleasant surprise, Vijay. I thought you were doing garment business in Joburg." "Shriki, you bandicoot. What are you doing here? I heard that you have become a finance wizard and have a great job in Stockholm. Great to see you, my friend." "Oh yeah, I am here for an investor meeting. And you?" "Well, I am here to source material for my shop. I am doing well in South Africa and can now afford the luxury of a 5-star hotel. Look, I have to hurry for some business meetings and shall be back in the evening. Why don't you join me for dinner at 9? I am in 4051. Okay, I am in 1101. I too have to hurry now. Catch you later. That evening, they had a third guest with them for dinner. Srikant was introduced to one Mr. Chorda, who was a South African. He was nattily dressed and looked every bit an influential man. Srikant, Mr. Chorda here is close to Nelson Mandela and is actively involved in the struggle in South Africa to get rid of white rule. He is a freedom fighter, isn't it, Mr. Chorda? I thought Chorda was an Indian name. I have heard that a lot of Indians are there in your country. Mr. Chorda smiled and explained, "You are partly right and partly wrong. My ancestors were from India and went to South Africa in 1771. Interestingly, my ancestor was exiled from India by the Dutch for conspiring with Hyder Ali, then the king of Mysore. You are wrong, because we are now fully integrated into our country and no more consider India as our homeland. Most of us do not speak Indian language or visit India ever." "Interesting indeed. So what brings you to India now?" "I had some official business here and shall be returning tomorrow. Funny, but I had never met Srikant in South Africa. We met here in this hotel." Srikant and Chorda were discussing South African politics for a while, and Srikant could gather that the freedom movement there had gathered momentum and was gaining good ground. Chorda was sure that the power had to shift to the blacks sooner than one would have thought. Srikant was also telling Chorda about his elder brother Ajay and how he had set up a very successful business in Russia. Chorda then rose to leave. "Sorry, but I have an early morning flight to catch. Hope you will excuse me." He then left, only to return, looking worried. "Vijay, I had ordered some shirts which were supposed to be delivered by the tailor here at the hotel. He just called me to say that they can be delivered only tomorrow and I won't be there to collect them." "Don't worry, Mr. Chorda. I'll collect them from the tailor and bring them to South Africa. Just give me his phone number." After he left, Louis and Vijay chatted for a long time, recalling their days in Lucknow. His father was ailing and all the three brothers were overseas. Ajay in Russia and Rakesh in China. Both of them were doing well. "Are you safe in South Africa? What with all the violence and civil war?" "Oh, it's safe for us there. The fight is between the blacks and the whites, not with us. You know, this is going to bring big business opportunities for me and I am already preparing for it. Be safe and wish you good luck." End of chapter 4. Keep listening. Vanished, created and narrated by Ravi. The South Africa Saga, Part 2. The chance meeting with Chorda was about to change Vijay's life. He returned to Johannesburg, with Chowda's shirts. Chowda and Vijay became good friends. South Africa in the 90s was a cauldron, and the arrest and confinement of Nelson Mandela only worsened the situation. The civil war against apartheid and white rule had intensified. Meanwhile, Chowda had introduced Vijay to some very key persons in the freedom struggle. Among them were Mbeki and Zuma. History was created when Nelson Mandela was elected as the first black president of South Africa in 1994, with Mbeki as the deputy president. The dramatic changes in the country paved the way for the rebuilding of South Africa, with black South Africans now driving the policies. The president wanted the least dependency on whites, and he turned to countries like India for help and support. It was thus that the business opportunities for Indians opened up in South Africa, and amongst the first to jump on to the bandwagon was Vijay, who was already close to the power center. He called on his brother Ajay to visit South Africa and evaluate the opportunities. Ajay impressed Chowda and Mbeki, and also managed to befriend Zuma. With big money on the horizon, political corruption became rampant. Vijay and his brother were soon the major conduits for all kinds of political gratification, and they were rewarded with big contracts and key assignments. Very soon, the brothers became important players in politics also, and could use their relationships to appoint anyone to any position in the government setup. They were also wooed by global investors of every hue to help them get opportunities to set up businesses in the country. Ajay and Vijay were now kingmakers. The Sharma brothers' empire was fast expanding, and it was at this juncture that Vijay turned to his old friend Srikanth for help. He was aware of Srikanth's standing as finance expert and wanted to enlist his help to manage and control the finances of the Sharma conglomerate. Srikanth agreed and joined the brothers in the year 2001. Nelson Mandela did not run for a second term, and in 1999, Mbeki took over as the president of South Africa with Zuma as his deputy. This was a big boost to the Sharma brothers, who were now virtually ruling the roost. Both Mbeki and Zuma were known to Ajay and Vijay, but very soon they would be caught up in a battle of loyalties. The first term of presidency for Mbeki was a defining one. He had taken a stand on corruption and set up a task force to investigate complaints of corruption against his cabinet. Zuma's name would come up first in one and thereafter in many cases, including complaints of rape. Meanwhile, Srikanth was also getting to know his friend as a businessman and power broker, facets that were unknown to him. The more he discovered, the worse it got. The friend in school was not the same as his employer friend. They were two different human beings, and he feared the second friend. Had he made a mistake by coming to South Africa? As the head of the group's finances, his involvement in everything that had to do with money became inevitable, and he was very disturbed. Huge cash flows were indicators of bribes being paid by the group to buy politicians, government officials, and various influencers who helped the brothers. Positions within the company were filled up with people related or close to the power centers. No wonder the brothers were popular. They had virtually bought out the government. He also discovered that the brothers were very close to Zuma and were a bit wary about the incumbent president Mbeki, although they made sure that they were in his good books. These discoveries made Srikanth rue his decision to quit his professional career for a group run by a family. He tried talking to Vijay, but could never get his message through. Ajay would assure him that all was well and that they were not doing anything against the government policies. He also told Srikanth that corruption was part of any government setup and it was universal and not limited to South Africa. Srikanth understood what Ajay was trying to tell him. Corruption was indeed a global phenomenon, but Srikanth never was or wanted to be a part of it. He could not fight corrupt governments or corrupt businesses, but to be part of a corrupt conglomerate was something that frightened him. How could he get out of this? He wondered. End of chapter. Keep listening. Vanished, created and narrated by Ravi. Chapter 5, The Battle and Other Murky Developments. Deputy President Zuma succeeded in wriggling out of most of the cases against him. But when his financial advisor confessed to receiving bribes on his behalf, President Mbeki grabbed the opportunity and threw Zuma out of his cabinet, thus stripping him of his post as deputy president. This was in the year 2005, and Zuma took the battle to President Mbeki relentlessly. By this time, the Sharma brothers had also cultivated Zuma and were covertly supporting him to the dismay of Mbeki. The situation grew complicated for Srikanth. There was a spate of political assassinations, some of which he feared was orchestrated by the brothers. He was now desperate to leave the group and move out of South Africa. In his role as the finance head, he now had been forced to involve himself in all kinds of murky deals and transactions. The political situation was volatile, and if things went wrong, he could well end up as a scapegoat for the sins committed by the brothers. Talking to his school friend was futile, as the brothers were now riding on a new high. The Sharma brothers were in fact plotting and planning to somehow get Zuma elected as the next president of South Africa. The elections were due in 2009, and the brothers were getting more and more ruthless and reckless in their actions, supremely confident of having their way. Their power and clout were now unparalleled. Srikanth was sickened by these developments, and with each passing day, his life became miserable. He felt suffocated and helpless. There was no one he could turn to for help. He was getting more and more paranoid and depressed, and this was also telling on his health. He had already sent his family back to India, fearing their safety. The change in Srikanth's demeanor was not lost on Vijay. He could understand that Srikanth was disturbed and was in some kind of emotional battle with himself. He knew the reasons and was not surprised when Srikanth packed off his family to India. He never thought that Srikant would be a brave heart like him and his brothers. He knew that his friend would never understand or share the vision of his family. But he had been a very valuable asset to them in navigating these stormy times. Vijay wished that Srikant could continue at least till the elections were done. But that may not be so. Vijay had spoken to his brother about Srikant and what to do with him. He was one person who had a very deep insight and knowledge about the affairs of the group. Could he pose a danger to them? Could he turn out to be a weak link, their Achilles heel? The current situation for the group was comfortable, but they were sandwiched between Mbeki and Zuma. Their support had primarily been for Mbeki, and he was popular and running a second term as president. But the African National Congress was unpredictable. Zuma had already lost his place in the government in the worst possible way and was smarting badly. He was street smart, wily, and still had an influence within the party. None of the cases against him had stuck in the courts, but the confession of his key aide had done him in. Did Srikant have it in him to protect the brothers if ever he was taken in? The brothers doubted. The Sharma brothers had already decided to put in their might behind Zuma, who they felt would emerge a winner in the end. They had done a lot of favors for him, but if their predictions did not come true, the group would be in trouble. So these were tense times, and they had to navigate very carefully. Moreover, they had to ensure that their own house was in order and there were no chinks in their armor. A decision on Srikant had to be made. They could either release him from the group or may have to work out some other plans for him, which could be unpleasant for both the friends. After all, Vijay considered Srikant as part of the family and empire. It was difficult for him to decide, and he therefore left it to the wisdom of his brother. President Mbeki's second term was nearing its inevitable end, and he knew that after his second term, he would not be eligible to run for a third term. However, he was not prepared to quit and was therefore making all-out attempts to convince his party to nominate him for presidentship for a third term. On the other hand, Zuma's efforts to win a nomination from his party was also making good progress. He had managed to win over most of his opponents and had the backing of a strong and moneyed lobby behind him. It was not easy and did involve some bloodshed, but it was worth the price. Srikant, meanwhile, was getting worse in health. He could not concentrate on his work. He worried endlessly and was fearful of everyone and everything. He felt that he was being watched constantly and followed wherever he went. His phones could be bugged, his food could be poisoned, and he could be killed any day, any time, anywhere. He desperately wished to share his woes with someone trusted, but he was isolated here in South Africa and had not kept in touch with anyone in India. Even if he had, he was afraid to communicate lest someone should find out. He knew that the brothers would not let go of him easily, for he had all the access to vital information about the group. There were several suspicious dealings in India as well. Srikant was not yet imprisoned, but he already felt that he was. He was at least relieved that his family was away from South Africa. Desperate thus to share his feelings with someone, he began writing diaries. Not the chronological stuff, but ramblings, often incoherent, mostly in despair. The handwriting veered from being legible and neat at times to often turn into scribblings as if done in a great hurry. In many places, the written lines would move from up to down instead of left to right. These were writings of a man going mad with fright and despair. End of chapter 5. Keep listening. Vanished. Created and narrated by Ravi. Chapter 6. Out of Africa. The year 2007 proved to be a very defining year for South African politics. It was also the year when the battle between the expelled and disgraced Zuma and the incumbent president Mbeki would be decided. Although constitutionally, Mbeki was not eligible for a third term as president of South Africa, he nevertheless chose to contest for the party elections to the post of president of ANC. Mbeki lost the election to Zuma, and with this, the road to becoming the president of South Africa literally reached the dead end. Zuma was now ANC's official candidate for the presidency of the country. This gave a boost to the confidence of the lobbies supporting Zuma, including the Sharma brothers. They would now be in full control and have complete immunity. 2007 also proved to be a defining year for Srikanth. Vijay was now free of the various insecurities he faced regarding his friend. It was also clear to him that Srikanth was no more required by the group as he had already stopped functioning effectively. Vijay knew the limited connections Srikanth had and was confident that the group's secrets would be safe with his friend. It was now time to bid him farewell, and he spoke about this with his brother. Meanwhile, Srikanth had given up all hopes of an early return to India and uniting with his family. The victory of Zuma meant that the brothers would now be the supreme force. The deals would become murkier, and the brothers would now need Srikanth more than ever before to manage the mess. There was no way out for him unless he somehow managed to escape. Fortunately for him, his passport was still with him. Srikanth tried to clear his head of the fears that haunted him and think clearly. He had to escape the clutches of the brothers, and he had to do it now. By virtue of his position in the group, Srikanth had opportunities to interact with many key officials in the government. While most of them were pawns and power brokers, there were a few conscientious ones who were quite disturbed at the state of their nation and its politics. They felt that it was better when the whites were in the power, as no one now seemed to have any interest about the country in their mind. There were corruption stories about all senior politicians, including Nelson Mandela, and this had many honest South Africans disappointed and frustrated. It was then that he thought of Wilfred. Wilfred was a senior officer in the Home Department, and Srikanth had met him on many occasions. They had discussed South African politics and prospects, guarded at first and then freely. Srikanth was able to see a glimmer of hope for him. He had a reasonably good relationship with Wilfred, and he could perhaps discuss his problems with him. He set up a private meeting with Mr. Wilfred Chuno. "Wilfred, I apologize for this cloak and dagger meeting, but it was absolutely necessary for me to see you." "I understand, Srikanth," said Wilfred. "You can speak to me freely with the confidence that whatever it is that we may discuss here today will remain only with me." "I really appreciate that, Wilfred. I am worried about what is going to happen in your country in a year's time, and afraid that it will affect me too."
"You mean when Zuma is elected as president?"
"My friend, there will definitely be a change for the worse. But who's caring about it? Not the citizens of this country, nor any other nation in the world. It is already infested by thieves and traitors. What worse can happen? Wilfred, I think I am in trouble. Rather, I am troubled by the things going on around me."
"Well," said Wilfred, "I used to wonder why a person like you left his good job to come to South Africa to join a group of thieves.
Srikant, the people you work for are ruthless, and it is your misfortune that you are laundering all the money for them. I know you don't have it in you to do all this dirty work. You look weak and sick, and I am guessing it is because of stress. Do you fear for your life? I heard that you have sent your family back to India."
"You're right, Wilfred. I have been living in fear for a long time. I have even spoken to Vijay, but he does not want to listen to me. He is my friend, but how much does friendship matter? Now they know that I am not happy with what they are doing. They also know that I know about their whole sordid business here. I am afraid I shall not leave your country alive."
"Do you want to go back alive?" Wilfred said. "I can help you, but you have to be very discreet and careful. If your plans are discovered, then I cannot say what will happen to you." With Wilfred's help, Srikanth managed to catch a flight to India. President Mbeki resigned in 2008. And in 2009, Zuma became the president of South Africa. Srikanth settled down in Mumbai and after a while seemed his normal and cheerful self. He, however, continued to write in his diary. His fears would not leave him in peace. He had visions of the Sharma brothers sending their goons to eliminate him. He would refuse to travel alone, even within Mumbai. Srikanth tracked the unfolding events in South Africa closely. He tracked the progress of his former employers and observed that they were indeed growing exponentially and getting richer and powerful by the day. A new finance head, an Indian, had replaced Srikanth. The brothers were acquiring lands near Lucknow, apparently for construction of a large township. There was no mention of Srikanth anywhere in the media. He wondered how his friend Vijay had taken his sudden disappearance. He must have been terribly upset and angry. Srikanth made sure that he had no documents of any kind relating to the group with him. He wanted freedom and was not interested in exposing the misdeeds of his employers. Srikanth, however, knew that he would be under some sort of surveillance by the brothers in India. While he took care to leave sensitive documents behind, he, however, kept one vital piece of evidence with him, probably as some kind of insurance. Immediately after his return from South Africa, he had also taken insurance on his life and that of his wife. It was a simple term life insurance policy for 10 million Indian rupees with the Life Insurance Corporation of India. End of chapter 6.
Keep listening. Vanished. Created and narrated by Ravi. Chapter 7. Damning Evidence. 2 years before he flew out of South Africa, Srikanth had made a stunning discovery. It was by a sheer accident, but the discovery was instrumental in Srikanth's decision to exit the group as well as the country. During the course of his employment, it was a routine for media personnel to hang around the group's headquarters. Some pressmen would want to interview the promoters or a senior functionary of the group. Media management was handled by a South African lady, and it was her responsibility to schedule appointments with the press and manage other engagements. In June 2006, Selina, the media head of the group, called Srikanth over the company intercom. "Good morning, Sri. How are you doing today?" "Hi, Selina. Good morning to you and glad to hear your voice. My day seems to have started off well. What can I do for you?" "Sri," said Selina, "there is a gentleman here, one Mr. Smith, from the International Press Group. He wants a meeting with you to discuss some financial aspects of the group." "Selina, you know I don't meet the press. Put him on to somebody who does." "Sri, I would have not called you without doing that. In fact, Vijay called me just now and told me to tell you to handle this interview. The group does not want to look evasive to the press and media. And the visitor seems to have some influence. He has, in fact, come through the boss himself." "Well, that is rather unusual, isn't it? Anyway, has he given you a questionnaire? I don't want to be surprised by pressmen." "Yes, he has. And I have put it on your mail." "Okay, give me 10. And then send him in." "Thanks, Sri." Srikanth read the questionnaire and was satisfied that there were no hidden surprises. It all looked routine. The meeting with Smith lasted for 45 minutes and Srikanth handled the queries comfortably. Just when Srikanth thought that the meeting was over, Smith looked at him and said, "Mr. Srikanth, I hear that you are not quite happy working here." Srikanth was taken aback and immediately went on alert. "Mr. Smith, you are free to hear and infer whatever you want, but I am afraid this is not on our agenda today." "Mr. Srikanth, I have carefully looked into your background and you hardly fit into this setup. We think that this group's bubble will burst. When? We don't know. There are people in the government who are closely tracking this group's finances and other activities. Look, I have a gut feeling that you are a straight guy. I am going to give you something and you have to promise me that you will keep it confidential. I got this from a very reliable source, but my group will not use this for a story. It's not in our line. You will get an idea of how far this group has gone to progress." Smith pressed a very small sized flash drive while shaking hands with Srikanth and then left. Srikanth watched the contents on his personal laptop soon after he returned home. What he saw was chilling and compounded the fears that were already haunting him. Obviously, somebody had secretly taken the pictures and his intentions were also very clear. This person was not a fan of the brothers, that was for sure. He could have been spying for someone, maybe, or could just be a well-wishing citizen sick of what was happening in his country. But why did Smith give this to him? What kind of files could be in his possession on Sharma Brothers? Why was the story not published? Had some political high-ups organized this, he would definitely have splashed it all across the globe. Could this be part of the battle going on between Mbeki and Zuma? The flash drive contained mostly photographs and two video clips shot with shaking hands by the mysterious photographer. The shaking of hands could not have been due to the fact that he or she was doing it at the risk of his or her life, or it was being shot secretly. It must have been fear, which even Srikanth could feel when he watched them. One of the videos showed a man tied and blindfolded, kneeling on the floor in a room with people around him. The language spoken was Zulu, which Srikanth did not understand. The visuals told the story though. Amongst the people surrounding the prisoners were Vijay and his brothers. The other three Srikanth could not identify. Of course, there was one more for sure, hidden behind the camera. It looked like the blindfolded man had done something really bad. The video was not continuous, and apparently the photographer was switching the camera off and on in between the shot. The final sequence showed an unidentified person pulling out a pistol and shooting the prisoner in the head. There the video ended. The second clip was more devastating. This was almost similar to the first one, except for the fact that it was a woman instead of a man who was bound and blindfolded. This time, however, when one of the men pulled out his pistol to shoot, Vijay's brother stepped forward and snatched the pistol from the man's hand, aimed it at the woman's head, and shot her thrice in the head. He then threw away the pistol and ordered the men to clear the body. Srikanth sat stunned for a long time. He could not believe that his friend and his brother could kill to grow their empire in South Africa. He did not like the bribing and power broking, but killing people in cold blood was something that shattered him. Srikanth's paranoia had now grown to such an extent that he would have done anything. He desperately wanted to talk to Smith to find out the other truths about the video and pictures. He tried calling on his number, but there was no response. He researched the media company where Smith was employed, but they told him that they had no such correspondent on their rolls. Who was Mr. Smith? Why did he come to Srikanth? And who had sent him? Was he somehow involved in all this? Was he the person who shot the film? His brain was bursting with a million questions coupled with a thousand fears. He had to find out. He had to talk to somebody. Somebody had to help him. He had to find a way to escape from this godforsaken company and country. Srikanth could not unravel the mystery, but Wilfred had helped him to escape safely to India. Srikanth left everything behind in South Africa, but he could never bring himself to part with the flash drive. He stashed it away safely behind the covers of his diary, till I discovered it after I had read the diaries left by him before his disappearance. Also hidden between the covers of the diary was a letter from Wilfred. There was no mention of Wilfred's letter in the diaries, but there it was, and with it, the answers that we all were so desperately trying to seek. End of chapter 7. Keep listening. Vanished, created and narrated by Ravi. Chapter 8, Wilfred. Some stories are best told in the words of the author, and Wilfred is one such story. The hidden letter from Srikanth's diary can best be described as an autobiography and an emotional outpouring, plus an appeal thrown in for good measure. This is what the letter said. "Sri, I do not know why I like you or why I am writing this letter to you. You will no doubt wonder how I came about your address in India. Friend, you know my position and status here. It was very easy for me to trace your whereabouts in India through my offices and contacts. No, do not worry, for I have no ill intentions, and neither will I bother to give your address to your company, sorry, ex-employers here. But I do not even need to, for if the brothers are looking for you, they will surely find you. I still very vividly recall our last meeting in 2007. It is now almost 2 years since you have left, or should I say escaped. I know you must be keeping track of events in South Africa after your surprise departure. Yes, the brothers are in command, I must say in full command, of the country and its affairs now. There are certain things I must now share with you at the risk of burdening your already stressed mind. When you decided to meet me, you must have mulled it in your mind. Finally, you must have thought that I am your best bet. I went through the same process before deciding to write to you. This letter will not reach you by the usual post or courier channels. You will find it at your doorstep one day. Well, where and how shall I begin to tell you what I want to tell? You might not know about this, but I am from a very humble background. My father, Junu Senior, was a very poor man, a farmer I can say, but he was also a patriot and had a keen interest in our nation and its history. Even as a child, I remember my father telling me stories about the Zulu people. He told me about the various Zulu tribes and how our King Shaka finally united them. He spoke of the valor of Zulus and how they fought against the Boers and then the British. At some stage in his life, he decided to quit as a farmer and become a guide. Yes, a tourist guide. I don't know why I am telling you all this, but I know I must tell you all this because it is somehow going to lead to actually what I wanted to tell you. My father was truly Zulu in heart, but he was also a true Zulu in character. He married twice and had 4 children from them. He however managed to produce 12 more children. Don't ask me about their mothers because I do not know them. As my father would explain, "Look, son, 4 of you are from my legal wives. But you must understand that we Zulu people cannot be restrained, especially our men. Rest of your brothers and sisters are from here and there. You will understand when you become a man." Well, that was my father. One thing I have inherited from my father was his patriotic genes. Look, I was his son from the pack of 12 that he picked up from here and there. Yet my father loved us all and took as much care as he could possibly afford. I think you understand my love for my country. I do not believe in ranting about our history or sing patriotic songs to prove that I love my country. It is this love that made me study hard in my school and college so that one day I can grow up to serve my country. I did succeed, and as you know, I am now one of the important cogs in this government's wheels. I did my bit during the civil rebellion against the white rule, and I am proud of it. As you know, mere patriotism does not serve the purpose. One has to be practical, realistic, and smart enough to understand politics. I too learnt these lessons in politics during the rebellion and later when I joined the government. I am still learning. I admired Mandela when he selflessly led the freedom movement and later got bitterly disappointed when he took over as president. He was not infallible as I thought. His patriotism, which I never questioned, changed character when he became a politician. He had enough reasons to justify what he did and why. I was watching everything from my ringside seat, close, yet not part of it. Well, my disappointment and frustration with South African politics only grew as presidents changed, and yet I remained mute. I had no power to speak the truth or question those who abused power. That is what I thought. Then your brothers entered the scene and played their own games to win over even the most diehard patriots. Now it is only greed that rules the country, not the government. And I am really and truly sick of it. Yes, I have sullied my patriotism, indulging in service to the corrupt, and therefore I consider myself as part of the wreckers. Yet my conscience kept pricking me. My heart said that I must quit, and my mind said stay. I listened to my mind. My heart then consoled me and said, okay, stay if you want, but for God's sake, do something for your country. Don't just abandon it to the greedy wolves. I knew my heart was right. So was my mind. I had to be practical, yet do something to save my country. I hate the brothers and people like the brothers who have no stake in our country except poison it and corrupt it. I have met the brothers and others such many times over and have done things for them, not because I wanted to, but because I just had to do. You will surely understand me when I say this, for you too have been forced to do such things for similar reasons. My heart kept telling me that no country and no people can be chained for long, whether the oppressors are foreign or natives. They will have to someday face the people and be exposed. I still believe this to be true. Anyway, I began my own investigations discreetly, collecting anything that could one day help me in exposing the corrupt. I do not know whether you still have with you the flash drive that I had sent to you through Mr. Smith. I will not blame you if you have thrown it away. It was indeed revolting, and you must have noticed the shaking during one of the killings. It was my hand that was shaking with disgust and terror. You might have wondered who sent you the drive and why. We too had some interactions and exchanged some views, though not expressly. I could judge a man, well, so I believe, and I had you sized up. I knew your background and your professional graph. I had that personally researched exhaustively. I knew your heart and I sensed your fears. That is why I sent you the video, to put some sense in you of the dangers around your presence in the group. When you asked to meet me, I was surprised. How did Srikant manage to trace the video to me? What resources could he have? Had he shown it to the brothers? Was my reading of Srikant horribly wrong? Yes, I was afraid, Sri. I was afraid that I had made the worst mistake of my life. But when you told me about your troubles and there was no mention about the videos, I actually wanted to hug you in relief. A momentary thought flashed through my mind. Should I ask Srikanth about the flash drive? It was momentary and passed as soon as it appeared in my mind. I knew you had fully understood the treachery of the brothers, one of whom, I gather, is your childhood friend. Well, that is how you got the flash drive, and that is why I helped you escape. Now for the bitter bit. I do not know how long I shall manage to survive. I now have too many secrets with me. Secrets that I can use to expose the president and his henchmen. But I cannot use it here in South Africa. It's too dangerous. I don't care if I die. All of us have to. But I shall be dismayed that with me will die my secrets and the chances for my nation to know the truth and expose the traitors. So why is it that I turn to you now? You are not a South African and you have successfully escaped from this hellhole. Why would you have anything to do with the cold-blooded brothers and a rotting nation? Why should you help me? I saved your life and I believe that you owe me a favor. I am calling it now and will not blame if you say no. But I will appreciate your help if indeed you will help me. I have ample resources everywhere, but this is not the time or occasion to use them. I have simply lost trust in everyone, and I can now only ask you. I am proud that I am a Zulu and a patriot. Now it is time for me to prove it. I need to escape from South Africa and go into hiding. I have planned out what I shall do then. You, my friend, have to hide me in India. I have also planned for this. You just have to say yes, and I shall guide you forward. One more thing I must tell you now, before you read my letter and get too emotional. My request to you comes with a big price tag. A huge sacrifice is to be made by you. You must not and cannot share this letter or anything we do here on with anybody, not even with your family. The Srikanth that your near and dear people know has to die. Not literally die, but you have to vanish, just as I will from my country. Maybe forever, maybe for a short while, I cannot guarantee. But whatever happens, I assure you that no harm shall touch you. You shall come out of all this alive and happy. That I promise. I await your response. Please say yes. End of chapter 8. Keep listening. Vanished. Created and narrated by Ravi. Chapter 9. Viva South Africa. We have seen how this story panned out and what happened to Srikanth. I had finished reading the diaries, watching the videos, and reading Wilfred's letter. And the rest of the story? As the cliche goes, that is history. Srikanth vanished without a trace in 2010. I could infer from Wilfred's letter that it was written in 2009. We have seen the many conspiracy theories surrounding Srikanth's disappearance. Now I have one more, which I believe is closest to truth. Beginning in 2013, the story about Sharma brothers and their political clout began appearing in the South African media. The president's possible connection was being talked about. These stories began persistently appearing. In 2015, there was a story about a lavish wedding and an illegal landing of a plane at a military base authorized by the government. There were other stories too about how there was a clash of interests between the business owned by the brothers and one of the wealthiest business groups of South Africa. President Zuma's second term was also coming to an end in 2019, and the elections in his party for presidentship was scheduled before the country elected its president. The situation was similar to the one in 2008, when President Mbeki was forced to resign after losing the party elections to Zuma. Now it was Zuma's turn. He had done two terms as president, and a third was not sanctioned by the constitution unless he was re-elected by his party to represent the country for the third time. While Zuma did not contest the party elections, he had already propped up a favorite candidate who finally lost. So Zuma was in the same position as his adversary Mbeki was in 2008. Meanwhile, the brothers were running into all kinds of trouble. The group got involved in a bank scam and made headlines and forced other banks to cut off their relationship with the group. Some of their business deals failed, and more importantly, their friend and political powerhouse had lost the party elections, and his regime had come to an abrupt ending. Faced with the worsening situation, the brothers fled South Africa to some unknown destination. This triggered the collapse of the Sharma Empire. The brothers, I gather, are still at large and in hiding. Well, here is my theory about Srikanth's disappearance. He said yes to Wilfred's proposal. That is obvious. Somehow, Wilfred managed to spirit him away, and the two went into hiding somewhere in India, from where Wilfred launched phase 2 of his plan to liberate his country. Well, it seems that he succeeded, as both the oppressor president and the brothers are no more relevant to South Africa. For the brothers, they have become persona non grata in India as well, after the bank scam, as it was an Indian bank that was involved. Their ambitious project in Lucknow will never see the light of the day. Their assets in India have been seized and accounts have been frozen. Where is Wilfred now, and what is he planning? Will he now return to his country and let Srikanth go? Hopefully, someday maybe, sooner or later. Till then, all I can do is wonder at my friend. I am truly amazed to discover this part of Srikanth Sharma, Louis to me. Did he give up everything, his family, his friends and his very life, to join Wilfred in his struggle to get rid of his country of corruption? That he went into hiding and remains untraced is astounding. He deserves the highest award for bravery. Unfortunately, I cannot share this with Shreya or his children, not even my wife. His vanishment has to remain an unsolved mystery for everyone except me. Why me? Even I don't know where he is hiding or whether my theory is valid. For all intents and legal purposes, Srikant Sharma is deceased. I still cannot figure out why he left his diaries with me. Was there any message that I had missed? Does he need my help for anything? I may never know, at least till he returns. End of the story. I hope you enjoyed this story. This is a work of fiction, and most of the characters and situations are imaginary and not real. However, considering the time and backdrop of the story, certain individuals and events have been incorporated who and which are real to provide an authentic feel to the story. The political events and timelines described in the story are true and have been used to enhance the story. No political leader or political party is sought to be maligned or criticized, as this is not a political commentary but a work of fiction. The political climate of South Africa has been recreated with the help of numerous open sources of information freely available on the internet. Thank you for listening. Wait for my next story.